Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. I'm your host, Jesse Wenslaw. It's Thursday. It's Speak Up time. Thanks for tuning in. Today on the show, I am excited to be sharing a conversation I had yesterday with Dr. Dana Lepofsky, who is an archaeologist here at SFU and has done work around, well, all sorts of different things. We'll get into it in there about ethnomusicology and mariculture and just all sorts of stuff. So that's coming up in a few minutes. But I'm going to start the show with just a little bit of music to get things rolling. I guess I probably told you the story last week because I'm going to play Lucid. And last week we had Lucid in for a studio six session the day before this show on Wednesday. And I played some then. I'm going to play you a different song today. It's just, I'm really, really into Lucid right now. This track is called S-I-T-A, and you're listening to it on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Running backwards, running after time and things I couldn't capture.
Sundays in the afternoon,
past the point of no return. I'd watch my future burn if I could get to
Tuesday.
Everything gotta be God over Jesus, Alexander over Caesar. If I had you here with me, would you go down this trip with me? Would you go down this trip with me? Hey, would you go down this trip with me? Imagine Sundays in the afternoon. Handsomely, paying for my guilt and pain. Both them things I'm battling, trapped inside my inner world. When I feel I don't deserve your trust or love, wait, that's enough of you. Blocking blessings, I've been destined. No more interceptions. I hope you get the message. Imagine the magic. The moment I embellished in my madness, drinking from the fountain of my soul. Sundays in the afternoon, yeah. Imagine Sundays in the afternoon, yeah.
I am away from the day. I am always late. I will get there.
I am on my way, St. Peter, hold the gate. I am always late, I know.
I will get there. Sundays in the afternoon. Sundays in the afternoon.
Nurturing Resilience is a weekly support group for students of all genders who have experienced any form of sexual violence. Developed in partnership with the SFSS Women's Center, SFU's Health and Counseling Services, and SFU's Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office. This group meets weekly on Tuesdays, 2 to 4 p.m. from January 14th to March 31st. Please join us in room 0309 of the Health and Counseling Service Center, Burnaby Campus, located on the bottom level of Maggie Benston Center.
Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. I just heard SITA, Sundays in the Afternoon, by Lucid, who recently came by to do a Studio 6 live session. You can look forward to that coming out at some point in the future. And getting ready to fire up that interview to share my conversation with Dana. But I want to hear about some birds first. Yeah. So this is, you know it well, Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. A typical bird nest will have maybe 4 to 6 eggs neatly arranged for a parent to hunker down on. Now, meet the greater Rhea, South America's largest bird. Rheas are 4 to 5 foot tall, flightless birds that look a good deal like ostriches. You can find between 50 and 80 eggs in one Rhea nest, but they're not all from the same set of parents. Male Rheas mate with several females and then build a single nest on the ground to hold all the eggs from each of them. Female Rheas wander around during the breeding season and mate with different males, laying eggs in each of their partners' nests. Males usually stay put after breeding and attend the nest, but a male Rhea might recruit a lower-ranking male to look after his first nest while he goes off to start another nest, now mating with a second set of females. As the Rhea eggs are about to hatch, the chicks, while still inside the egg, begin to make a curious whistle. Imagine 50 or more, all whistling at once. Sometimes, young chicks like to nestle in the feathers of the male's back. Good thing he has such a nice broad back for all those chicks. For Bird Note, I'm Ashley Ahern.
Yeah.
To Myself by Ludic, off of a release by the same name, out now, or out soon on Kingfisher Blues. You can stream it now, and you will have it shipped to you around February 7th. Hot pop jams. I like it. And now we will get into the actual talk part of this show, which is why you've tuned in to Speak Up here on CJSF, to hear me and other people speak about things. And my guest today is Dana Lepofsky, who is an archaeologist, an ethnobiologist, working here at Simon Fraser University. We spoke about her recent article, Indigenous Songkeepers Reveal Traditional Ecological Knowledge in Music. We talked about rediscovering an ancient method of clam mariculture. And we talked a little bit about her general work and history as an archaeologist. And we talked about a talk that she is giving next Thursday, February 6th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. called The New Power Couple, Traditional Ecological Knowledge and Western Science Unite to Inform Sustainable Management of Clams. That is part of the SFU's 2020 Dean's Lecture Series, and that is at 5:15 West Hastings. You can find more info about it at sfu.ca. I'll give you more information about this after you've heard my conversation with Dana, which is going to start right now.
I'm Dana Lepofsky, and I teach here at Simon Fraser University in the Department of Archaeology. And I'm super privileged in that I get to work here on the Northwest Coast with Indigenous communities, for Indigenous communities in their territories, thinking about and investigating how people lived on the land in the past and placing that knowledge in kind of current social and ecological contexts.
How did you get into archaeology? Like, how did that become the channel?
Every archaeologist loves being asked this question. Mm-hmm. I got into archaeology like a lot of archaeologists. When I was little and in my backyard, I used to make Patty Gintel, my childhood friend, dig in my backyard with me. She hated it. I loved it. There wasn't ever thing close to an archaeological site, but we had fun. I had fun. She didn't. And then I forgot about that and my interest in kind of the past and in people until I got to university and actually took a terrible anthropology class, just awful. But still, it just resonated with me at my core that there was something there that I could do. So a lot of people, like, tell archaeologists, it's very common, I always want to be an archaeologist, but. Mm-hmm. So for me, I never had to face that, but because I happened to be at University of Michigan, which was at that time one of the leading archaeology programs in the world, probably, I had a supportive family. I just, like, the universe just unfolded to make it happen for me, so I don't have a but. I just got to do it, and I'm really, really lucky.
What then drove the connection to sort of Pacific Northwest, West Coast, Indigenous groups, and that field of archaeology?
Right. So I always tell my students that in your job cover letters, you make it sound like you had a direct path, mm-hmm. and that you knew where you were going to end up by doing all these steps. It was completely not the case. I went on my first ever backpack trip with my boyfriend, and we were hiking the peninsula and the Cascades. And on the first trip, I saw my first switchbacks and helped carry my first backpack. And it was hard, hard, hard. At that point in my life, I wasn't really using my body physically like that. And we had to take a break because I was so sore. So we took the ferry to Victoria and went to the museum there. And that museum turned my life around, my head around. Mm-hmm. And on the ground floor was a sculpture of Nutchalmouth Whaling, then Nootka Whaling. And I was completely... Oh my God, I still can bring up that feeling. I was so taken by it. So I went back to Michigan and decided to do my honors thesis on Nutchalmouth Whaling. Hmm. And really, the rest is history.
Full disclosure, I am a graduate of the archaeology program here at SFU. Not currently
awesome.
Working as an archaeologist,
yeah.
But there's a feeling I get, and I have gotten going to...
BC Provincial Museum, it's not called that anymore,
yeah.
But yeah, the BCPM, yeah.
I can remember certain exhibits there and other places that it's almost like you see them or enter the space with them, and it's almost like the hair on the back of your neck stands up.
Yeah, there's some visceral connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's clearly what happened with that Nochelnoth Wailing exhibit, because it shaped my life in a way that I couldn't have known, but I did know that it kind of just, I don't know, it just hit a core value, a core interest, a core passion. You know, I never thought that I would end up, you know, fast forward in the McCall Longhouse trying whale blubber. You know, I just, you know, I didn't know that that's how my universe would unfold, but that was a pivotal moment.
And so since then, you've obviously studied a lot of things and done a lot of different work. One of the things that seems to be a through line, or has become a through line anyway, is this sort of interdisciplinary approach and the marrying of different information sources and different approaches. Did that just sort of develop organically?
So it's interdisciplinary, intercommunity for me. So that means, like you said, different knowledge sources, whether they be in the academic world or outside. In a way, part of it developed organically because I'm a community kind of person. I just went back and visited the community that I grew up in, Connecticut, and I realized how much that was part of kind of who I am, that I'm used to being in community. I create community if there isn't around me. And also cultural diversity. The place I lived in Connecticut was a lot of quote-unquote ethnic diversity. So diversity and community were kind of in my fabric, and I came from a family where that was embraced. So that was a big part of who I am. I'm also kind of a party organizer. I like bringing people together. Mm-hmm. That's part of being interested in community, sure. But I also like organizing events. Everyone knows in the family there's going to be an event that I'll organize it. So it meant that kind of really to satisfy my passions and really to tackle some of these problems that were difficult, it made sense to bring in different kinds of knowledge holders and diverse kinds of methods and to be respectful to those different kinds of knowledges, whether they're from, you know, the Department of Biology here or from indigenous communities somewhere in the world, that we all bring different kinds of ideas and skills, strengths and weaknesses to the table. So what's neat is that, for me, is that the discipline has changed or evolved in that this is now becoming it's quite common, mm-hmm. or increasingly common for people to do interdisciplinary work and to look to indigenous knowledge holders and bring them in. It's not as common as it should be yet, but it's definitely evolving. So I frankly have never been happier with my work as an archaeologist. My privilege has never been greater than it is now.
Well, it's interesting because there's, as you were saying, it's becoming more common to seek out different sources of information and knowledge. But in archaeology and in just sort of, I guess, Western scientific pursuit generally, there has been this sort of idea that if you're not part of the people who know, who are doing things the one specific way, then there's not as much value to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and that's still, I mean, it's still there. That's still very much there. So I heard correctly saying it's evolving. It has. We haven't arrived by any means. There's a paper that just came out that several of us are actually writing a rebuttal to, in that they tout interdisciplinarity and they say, look how great we are. We're looking at this, and we can show that basically indigenous land use has not left a legacy in the ecological record today, and that it really was never very extensive in the past. Well, they actually do bring a lot of kinds of paleoecological data, like pollen and charcoal and archaeology in this case, but they forgot to talk to indigenous people or to look at kind of the ethnographic record in detail. And so a more nuanced and interesting question would be, given that there is so much evidence in the ethnographic record or, you know, among knowledge holders of this kind of behavior of traditional management or whatever, why aren't we finding it in the paleoecological records? To me, that would be true breadth of knowledge seeking. And so you can see in that case that knowledge is defined very particularly about those who have it inside the academy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're quite right.
I know that and this is again drawing on the schooling in archaeology that I've had here, that in classical archaeology, in a lot of other branches of archaeology, like you would look back at written materials and you would say, what did these tell us and how does the archaeological record
conflict with this or confirm this. And barring that, you go back and you look at who are the ethnographic descendants of the people who had these lifeways or who were living here. But it's interesting that the archaeological evidence seems to have sort of like a primacy, or that seems to be, well, if this is what the hard science tells us, then that must be what's quote-unquote right.
This is such a good observation, and I really think that social scientists, and in fact all scientists, maybe not all, maybe not physicists, I actually don't know, but a lot of scientists are grappling with that idea of kind of what is right. How do you know you're right when you, how do you know? And kind of the standard way would be hypothesis testing and kind of, you know, but even in the hypothesis testing language, you're not supposed to ever say that you've proven a hypothesis. It's just the one that's currently standing. So probably that language and that framework isn't the best way for dealing with traditional knowledge and embracing traditional knowledge. I think, though, that in North American archaeology, anyway, there's definitely been a definite move toward embracing that knowledge and meaning that you have to do a different kind of science. So I'm put in for a proposal, and they want to know my methods. And I have a line in there saying that there is angst around telling you what my methods are, given that this is a community-based project and I want the methods to arise. So I'll tell you how I'm going to meet with the community and what we're going to do to develop those methods. But it's going to look really different depending on community needs and community desires. So that alone from like the ground up is going to look different than, you know, how it would be if I'm going to go out and tell you exactly where I'm going to sample and what I'm going to sample. Mm-hmm. So that grant could be dead in the water if it goes to my colleagues who believe that there's one right way to do archaeology. And it could.
It's interesting because that, like the differences in experimental design, I guess, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. those are going to determine the kind of information that you get as
100%.
Well. 100%. Right?
Exactly. I think that that has been a recognition increasingly in science, is that, you know, the answers we get are dependent on how we crafted the question, right?
Yeah,
so for sure. So once we start bringing communities in and asking, what questions do you want to ask, that will determine our methods. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, 100%. And that's appropriate here because we're talking about heritage. We're talking about someone else's heritage, mm-hmm. who gets to talk about that heritage and decide that. There are some ethical baselines that, you know, we won't go beyond as archaeologists. But, you know, my ethical baseline is try to find out the maximum information with the minimum amount of disturbance to the archaeological record. That's the kind of foundational model I have for my research design. After that, it's all fair game.
You talked a little bit earlier about sort of having to take new approaches or different sciences or different scientific approaches. You're part of a speaking event that's coming up next week, February 6th, I think, that is called The Marriage of...
It's called...
The New Power Couple.
Yeah, which actually... You know, full disclosure, that had to be explained to me.
Sure.
Because I'm so not connected to popular culture, but everybody else knew but me.
The New Power Couple, Traditional Ecological Knowledge and Western Science Unite to Inform Sustainable Management of Clams. So that seems like you're talking about a way of potentially marrying two different streams or using one source of knowledge to inform another.
That's exactly right. And I think that the best kind of discussion is an iterative one. So actually, it is a backing and forth thing, because there's a lot of truths in science that don't hold up, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of truths in oral knowledge that don't hold up, or not a lot in both ways, but there are some in both contexts. So that backing and forth thing is a really exciting thing, I think. So in this talk, I'm so lucky that I'm going to actually be kind of bookended by two extraordinary knowledge holders, Kim Rakalma Kludisi Ogologa from the Qualicum Nation, who was married to Kwaksisala Wathla Chief Adam Dick, who just passed about a year and a half ago, was one of the major knowledge holders of the Kwak Kwak Kwak. And so she's going to be talking about kind of clams and clam gardens and how that knowledge was brought forward to the Western scientific community through Adam, and Adam actually singing a song and all the knowledge that's embedded in song. And then on the other side is going to be Elroy White, who's an archaeologist, got his degree from our department, and Kitasu, I think, is one of his traditional names. And Elroy will talk about kind of clam management, clam use, clam gardens in his territory, and how clams sit today. So I'm in the middle kind of, again, bookended by these amazing knowledge holders talking about kind of the Western scientific perspective and what have we learned about clams and clam gardens, really kicking off from Adam's knowledge and Elroy's knowledge and other people like that. So it's very much a marriage of different ideas, and it's been quite the ride.
Yeah, well, I was really interested. I mean, that's sort of an intersection of my interests in terms of like music and archaeology, and the idea that in an article you co-authored, songs are described as detailed biocultural archives.
Yeah.
And that phrase to me just, it like set off all sorts of things in my brain. It's just a very interesting concept, and something I don't know if you would necessarily just on its face think of a song being a biocultural archive.
Well, do you as a musician, like, now that resonate
with you? It
makes sense,
for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm listening at this moment to a podcast that's each episode is an hour-long breakdown lyrical analysis of an album, and each hour-long episode is one song.
That's
and,
amazing.
Just thinking about that and thinking about the kind of information that you are able to convey through lyrics and through references and through just all the different meaning in there is very interesting.
Yeah, so this whole song journey, I live with musicians, mm-hmm. so, you know, I'm totally a wannabe, and so I appreciate music and all that in the ways that, you know, touches your heart and body and soul and mind, and mm-hmm. just, you know, that the power of music that way. But how this is a whole volume that came about in it's a special issue of the Journal of Ethnobiology, which I edit, called The Ethnobiology of Songs. And it looks at traditional songs of indigenous people around the world, and asks what's all the biocultural, the ethnobiological information embedded in them. How this came about was through Quetzalcoatl, through his singing of the Lokiwe song. And that's what introduced me to Quetzalcoatl, to Adam, and Adam became a dear friend and mentor. And you'd be sitting around eating with Adam at his house, and I don't know, maybe someone would serve ooligan or something, and then Adam would just start going to get this far off look in his eyes and start tapping on the table and to a beat and sing you a song. And Adam knew hundreds of songs about the way the world worked. Mm. Hundreds. So they were specific songs. And so for the taste of clam gardens, it was about the Yaya song. And basically Yaya has to do with this dog tradition and these dog children. And that's one of the oldest oral traditions on the coast. It's shared by Salish people and Kwak 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 people and Helsik people. And basically it teaches to go down to the beach and roll the rocks to get me my clams, roll the rocks, go down to the Lohiwe. And it's really that song and all the songs that Adam shared with me and the many, many more that he knew are what inspired that. And I put the word out saying I want to do this special issue, and it sat for a year or so mm-hmm. on our website, our journal website. And then my now such dear friend, Alvaro Fernandez Yamazares from Spain, contacted me and said, I'm an ethnobiologist, I'm a musician, and would you like to do this with me? And then there started this amazing journey of bringing in people around the world who were also taken by the power of song. So it's detailed knowledge about the way the world works, the biological world and the non-biological world, and people's place in it. And we know that about language and storytelling, but I think we've forgotten that songs have that same power.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they do. We, you know, and so it wasn't missed by the people, the administrators in the residential schools at all. Like, you,
right.
you got beaten for, you know, singing a First Nations song.
Anything that wasn't a hymn.
And you got replaced with hymns. So they knew the power of song big time,
mm-hmm.
which is just so interesting to me. So when I looked at the Truth and Reconciliation recommendations, they actually don't talk about song. They talk about language.
Mm-hmm.
It's missing. We need to actually think about song as it's kind of a parallel. It's a subset. It's greater than language. There are kinds of language and stories that end up in song that never end up in spoken language. So it's more than language in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah, I think like what gets chosen to put into a song is, I mean, like just simply that it has been chosen to be made into a song is
yeah.
relevant, but also just like songs are a way of encoding language as well, and then making it easier to remember specific
yeah.
things, right? Like I remember song lyrics better than I remember just like a list of sentences that are unconnected.
Totally true. So it's about conveying meaning, remembering meaning, giving importance to meaning, all kinds of things are embedded in that. And what's really neat about song too is that there's ethnomusicologists and psychologists who have done research on song and on the universality of song, like what makes a lullaby is cross-cultural. Well, you say, yeah, but that's obvious. Well, actually, it's not.
Right. It seems obvious because it's so cross-cultural.
But So they've done really neat work kind of, you know, in diverse songs, diverse cultures, looking at what are the commonalities, and there's quite a few. It's really, even talking about it, just, you know, talking about making your hair stand, and it totally, when I think of a song, mm-hmm. you know, it's really so much into our fabric from the get-go. Mm-hmm.
The way singing makes you feel, and the way, like, it does seem much, maybe not much more, but it does seem like there's, it exists on, like, a more fundamentally human level than any particular language might, I guess, this, like, drive to music or this drive to song.
Agreed, and some of the, you know, instruments are old, like people making sounds, and the oldest instruments are really, they seem to be about making noises to talk to the plant and animal world, right? So to talk to the world around you and the plants and animals that are actually there, and the spiritual plants and animals. So it's about communication in all kinds of directions. Yeah, it's neat.
Yeah. The song you... that we've sort of mostly mentioned about the clam beds and rolling the rocks so that you can get the clams. I watched, there's a video on the Hoyette website, which is hoyette.ca, that gives like a really interesting, the website itself gives just like an overview of the area and has like little sort of vignettes about different mm-hmm. parts, different sites, things like that. And there are a couple of videos of these clam beds. When you look at them and you know that they are a human feature.
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
Yeah.
But it's also the kind of thing that until you hear someone say, oh, you roll the rocks to make the clam bed, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so we actually put the prettiest ones, right?
Of course.
Yeah, sure. So they're the most obvious. Yeah. And, you know, there's some that are really stacked high and mm-hmm. pancake flat on the website. But there are others that are less obvious. And the truth is, they are mostly underwater. Mm-hmm. So to be fair to all of us who didn't get to hear from elders directly, that we didn't know that there were these gardens as ways of cultivating clams at the lowest intertidal, they're only really visible for like, oh, I don't know, 5 to 8 daylight hours. Is that about right? No, probably less than that. It's probably 5 to 8 days per month in May, June, July, and August, probably for about a 3-hour window each.
Right, because it's the lowest point of
the tide. It's the lowest low.
Yeah.
That's right. And so then in places where sea level has declined, mm-hmm. has gone down since the building of the walls, they're
more
exposed.
Obvious.
Yeah, they're a little more obvious. But in places like the Gulf Islands where sea level has come up, you only get the very lowest tides, just the top mm-hmm. of the rock wall. It doesn't look like much. So if you don't know it's there, you know, it's definitely invisible. But this is a really good case of kind of not stopping and listening and recognizing indigenous knowledge, because had we asked, had we paid attention, had we come to Kwaksisdala, you know, a while ago, he would have said, yeah, those are Lohi way. I made ones. That's what he says. He said, I didn't understand why I was being asked the question. It seems so obvious to him. So we just weren't, we had an idea mm-hmm. and we were right. That clams were not cultivated, that clams are not that important. It's all about salmon, all those rock walls. If we saw them, there were fish traps for salmon, never for herring, because herring wasn't important, another truth in mm-hmm. local archaeology. Yeah, and we just needed to ask.
Well, I think that that's a through line. There are a lot of assumptions that are made based on whatever we already know or think we know, and a lot of that knowledge has been suppressed or eradicated or pushed to the margins where it's not necessarily, it's there if you ask, but if you're not, it's not presented as obviously.
Yeah. And I think worldview matters so much, because even people who are working with indigenous peoples, if you didn't believe that people were managing the foreshore, or the terrestrial landscape, then it just went a twig. Like, you just didn't have a way to anchor it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, that code was broken in the academic world by my mentor and friend, Nancy Turner. And Nance is many wonderful things, but one of them is that she's a really respectful listener. Doesn't matter who, what culture. So Nance listened all over the years, and then she started realizing they're talking about cultivation. And it was, you know, because she listened so carefully and so respectfully. And then once Nance kind of cracked the code for us about terrestrial management and the management of plants, but also then kind of the occasional talking about, you know, the marine environment, then it was all fair game. And then really what we know now is that, not surprisingly, and it's true for many indigenous people around the world, and certainly coastal peoples, that they're managing from the lowest intertidal to the highest terrestrial areas in a continuum of practices that are, again, global.
Because why wouldn't you?
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Right. And I think there is that with indigenous communities here, because they are so decimated and so secluded, well, secluded isn't the right word, but sort of concentrated away and not in...
They're like separated from urban life,
specific
for sure.
Places.
Oh, in lots of cases, yeah.
But there's the assumption that they were only living in certain places doing certain things, as opposed to
definitely
living in these areas
definitely
and exploiting every ecological niche and et cetera,
The thing is about BC, though, is that we're extraordinarily privileged to have really thriving indigenous communities and indigenous knowledge holders in the city and outside of the city. But it was just stopping to listen, like in other places of the world, is there is more of a disconnect between that traditional knowledge and the past. But even so, there are traditional knowledge holders in many places. You know, it depends on the amount of disease, the amount of colonial repression, et cetera, et cetera. But here, there's a lot of knowledge. It's extraordinary, really, that way, that there is such a thriving indigenous population. And we live in a country that purports to support indigenous rights and title. Now, that's a whole other interview right there. But at least that is part of what we believe we do in Canada.
Well, you've got this talk coming up at the beginning of February. What's next for you research-wise or ongoing for you?
What's
the next thing that you're excited about?
Yeah, so two things. I'm super excited. One is this project that I've put in that I mentioned for on one of the Gulf Islands, where I'm asking the question is, what does community-based archaeology look like? And I've invited all 13 nations who lay claims to this island to come and help us figure that out with the settler community, because I really believe that we are not going to go forward in terms of heritage preservation, conservation, awareness, respect, without bringing in the settler community into the discussion fully. Because people have connections to those places as well. And so that, I'm super excited about that. It's going to be a logistical... Yeah, it's going to be logistically full. I'm also... We're starting a project up with the Gitgat up in... around Hartley Bay, and this is talking about interdisciplinarity and crossing knowledge. This is the site where the Queen of the North went down 10, 12 years ago, whenever that was. It's a place, I can't pronounce the Somali name, the Gitgat name for it, but it's called Clamstown in English, and it's called that for the obvious reason is that people are going to harvest clams there for generations. In fact, we have some radiocarbon dates, thousands and thousands of years. It's a stunningly beautiful site, and it's they've taken all these clams and terraced these, you know, beautiful house platforms. It makes for just this beautiful open forest today, fronting this very productive clam beach, which it turns out is no longer polluted from the Queen of the North going down, which was the original reason for testing the beach, but has PSP, paralytical shellfish poisoning, harmful algal blooms. It's a more general name for PSP being one kind of HAB, and that some of the beach has these harmful blooms, and so people are getting discouraged thinking they can't go and collect clams anymore. So we're starting this multi-community, multidisciplinary project where we have someone who can specialize in PSPs, someone else who specializes in diatoms, someone else in ancient DNA, some archaeologists, we have marine ecologists, we have elders, local ecologists, basically to ask, can you use traditional management techniques to decrease the prevalence of these PSPs? Is it the decline of traditional management techniques and harvesting that actually has led to the increase? Can we look at the archaeological record and ask, how prevalent was PSPs in the record? how I say fat and happy were the clams in the past? How does that compare to the clams today? So we can get this long-term record by looking at the archaeology and compare it to today, to experimental ecological design kinds of results. And then we have this wonderful pairing with the indigenous knowledge about how they tended those beaches and so on, and the changes they see ecologically.
That's really exciting, because I think one of the things that really interests me about archaeology is how it can be used beyond just this is what things were like back then. Taking the information that you can get from it and actually applying it in to help solve a modern day issue.
Yeah, and going full circle to my original introduction, you said there was so much. So that was the other thread, is taking the past and contextualizing it in these modern contexts. It's really, for me, it's our, we'd be squandering our privilege as archaeologists if we did something other than that. Mm-hmm. And it can be all kinds of things, just like, you know, bringing it back to the community in terms of heritage and heritage reconnection. And there are, of course, all kinds of environmental concerns that we can be part of. The trick is for archaeologists, I think, is we like to say that we're relevant. But when push comes to shove, we don't sometimes go to the nth degree, because we're not policymakers. So what that means is working with policymakers, working with ecologists. We cannot be all those things, because archaeologists, we're a jack of all trades in some respects, and so that means that we can be at the center of all these multiple conversations.
Sort of interface with all the different
stuff. Absolutely, and we can be coordinators, but we need to bring all those other experts in, and a lot of those experts are going to come from the indigenous community as well.
Well, Dana, thank you for sitting down with me.
My pleasure.
That's great. Awesome.
My conversation with Dr. Dana Lepofsky. You can hear more of Dana talking about these stories and some of the things we touched on at a talk called The New Power Couple, Traditional Ecological Knowledge and Western Science Unite to Inform Sustainable Management of Clams. That is part of the SFU Faculty of Environment's Dean's Lecture Series. That is Thursday, February 6th, next Thursday, 7 p.m. at 515 West Hastings. It's free. You just got to register on the old internet. You can find that on Eventbrite or on sfu.ca. We also touched briefly on a website, the Huyat Village, where much of Dana's research about clams was based. And part of the work there was gathering all the, well, documenting all the work they did and taking pictures and videos and audio recordings of stories and all sorts of stuff, and putting it together on this website called Huyat, where it's huyat.ca, huyat.ca. And you can just go through this whole sort of guided tour of the area and its history, and it's just really, really great. There's sort of like a 3D Google Maps type walkthrough that you can go and look at all the different points of interest. So I'm going to play you the trailer for the website, or just sort of one of the main videos as a taste, and then you can decide to go see the rest yourself.
I was here for 2 or 3 years with my grandparents before I had to start going to school, so there's a few of us that this area means a lot to us.
You are who you are as a Hiltzog. All the time I'm out there, my lesson is that I Hiltzog, I speak the language, because that's all that was spoken out there, Hiltzog.
It was the most natural place to learn, to grow, to connect, to heal. We have a teaching that is that if we need to do healing work, we have to go where the spirits have not been disrupted.
This place has a lot of memories. As our people used to use this place all the time. There was a time when you could walk across here, and that's how much salmon there was here.
We used everything that our oceans and our lands provided.
The scale upon which we're talking about, you know, the access to fish is quite a bit larger than what anybody in this community now could even fathom.
My good memories of it was the time I spent with my grandparents and my great-granny.
So it would be right from the little guys to the older people, and everybody played a role. And just working together as family was important for Hillsook people.
He said there was a lot of family. He said, we're here. There was a lot of smokehouses on both sides.
Take care of our territory. Take care of our land. By taking care of it is to live it. You got to live it to take care of it. And that's what the responsibility you have in those places like Hoyt and everywhere.
What Hoyt means to me, like it was our family's homeland.
It's important to go revisit where your ancestors were at one time.
We need to go because we need to see where we were and what our parents and our grandparents did.
You can find more at hoyat.ca, hauyat.ca. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And now, local talent. Thank you.
like music or do you like technology? Or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
CJSF would like to welcome you to a new series highlighting local artists and creatives alike. It's Studio 6, featuring live performances and panel discussions. Studio 6 is geared to bringing local content to you via CJSF 90.1 FM at cjsf.ca/studio6. Visit cjsf.ca/studio6 to find the latest performance or discussion. Want to contribute to Studio 6? There are lots of opportunities for brands and groups to join in. Just visit cjsf.ca/studio6 for more info.
Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio from Simon Fraser University, where we, of course, broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. We stream online at cjsf.ca. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter. Listen to podcasts on SoundCloud, our website. You can call if you have a request or whatever at 778-782-CJSF, 778-782-2573. You can text in too. Democracy Now! Is coming up next. And to take us there will be a track from Studio 6. This is Graftician from their Studio 6 session, a track called Mostly Ocean. I'm Jesse. I will see you this time next week. Bye.
Since we are more. know that, and I know that, and we know that, yeah. And you know that, and I know that, and we know that, yeah. Only the polyester will last, but this love isn't made of that. We'll never don't be mad when you see me as I am. And only the plastic packages last, but lover, that's not what you have. Don't